The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this is the last talk in this series on Kalyana, beauty or beautiful. And if the word Kalyana is translated as beauty or beautiful, then we see that the Buddha in his teachings is filled with references to beauty and creates a very different flavor or orientation for understanding the teachings of the Buddha than if Kalyana is translated as good. It evokes something that's more holistic in us. Good tends to evoke ideas of ethics, morality, or something vague, some idea of should, maybe, obligation. But the ideas of beauty and beautiful can perhaps awaken not so much should and obligation, and not so much ethics and morality, automatically or only, but rather something that's holistic, some connection to aesthetics, for sure, to our emotions, to wider range of sensitivity that we have, the kind of range of abilities to be aware, to be sensitive, that really is tapped into and awakened through mindfulness. And perhaps by referring more often to beauty, it's easier for awareness, mindfulness to touch into or awaken or be part of this field of beauty, harmony, peacefulness, goodness, and also virtue that can be within us. So we talked the first day about just the fact that the Buddha does talk about beauty, and he's talked about the Dharma being good, being beautiful in the beginning, in the middle, and the end. And I think he's talking about here about the path of practice, the deepening, the maturing in the Buddha Dharma. And it begins by discovering something, and for this week is discovering this potential, this capacity for beauty. And then we encounter people who are beautiful friends, Kalyanamitta. And the beautiful friends are those who support us in the practice and point us to the practice. And to spend time with Kalyanamittas, to spend time with people who know this kind of beauty. There's one quote. The Buddha says, you should recollect, you should remember beautiful friends in the following way. It is truly my gain, my good gain, that I have beautiful friends who care for me, who desire my good, who advise me and instruct me. Another place where he talks about Kalyanamittas, he says, and what is beautiful friendship? There is the case where lay people, in whatever town or village they may dwell, spend time with householders or householders' offspring, young or old, who are advanced in virtue, abounding in faith, abounding in virtue, abounding in generosity, abounding in wisdom. They talk to them, engaging them in discussions. So here, lay people, people of the world, not even monastics, what makes a person a beautiful friend is that they are abundant in virtue, faith, generosity, and wisdom. Beautiful qualities that we all have the capacity to cultivate and develop, that we can be inspired by other people who have those qualities. And here we get a sense of what the Buddha puts value in, that these are what's important in the world, much more so than material success or athletic success or wealth or knowledge even, knowing the Dharma a lot. But these beautiful qualities of mind, heart, that's what makes a Kalyanamitta. And Kalyanamitta support people in engaging in a practice. And One of the things that Kalyanamitta supports people to do is establishes them on the Eightfold Path. And this Eightfold Path, the core kind of formulation of the Buddhist practice, is at times called Kalyanavatta, a beautiful practice. These beautiful practices. And so this idea that over and over again, a reference point is beauty. It might get kind of tiring to hear this word over and over again, but to that, you know, where do we look? How do we feel? What is it? How do we address? How do we engage in it? How are we in harmony with it? What flavor of involvement with these things does it call upon us? Call from us? If the reference point is beauty and beautiful, what is that? You know. I think it calls on something, awakens something very precious, very different orientation. Also, as I talked about how then at Kalyanamitta, that the Buddha talked about, sometimes he talked about good karma with using the word Kalyana, and that beautiful karma has a very different feeling than good karma, doing beautiful karma. But we can even be a little bit more nuanced with this, and that is that the word kamma, the Pali word for karma, literally means action. And in the teachings of the Buddha, sometimes it really just means action without necessarily any reference point to the idea that karma theory, karma principles. And so you get a very different feeling if you just simply call it good action, acting in beauty, a beautiful action. So, for example, non-greed, non-hate, non-delusion are the cause and condition for beautiful action, for the occurrence of beautiful action. And this has a lot to do with the goal of Buddhist practice, is to come to a place where there's no greed, no hatred, and no delusion. The absence of greed, the absence of hatred, and absence of delusion is the source for living in the world with beautiful action, beautiful karma, beautiful. Becoming established in the beauty of the Dharma, through practice, through the Eightfold Path, and then becoming skilled in the beauty of meditation. Meditation being in samadhi, beautiful of samadhi, the last step of the Eightfold Path. And the fact that samadhi is associated with beauty is fascinating, that this deep inner capacity for unification, subtleness, focus, concentration is moving towards what's beautiful. Maybe evokes a very different motivation to concentrate than it is to kind of just for the purpose of concentration and we bear down or focus. The very act of getting concentrated should have some kind of harmony and beauty in it as well. And sometimes the fourth jhana is called sobhana. And sobhana is a different word meaning beauty. And that's kind of some of the most beautiful kind of worldly experiences a person can have, a mind which is settled and peaceful and focused. And a lot of that beauty is not so much that we're creating it and making it, but rather it's the beauty of absence. Just like if you look into a beautiful body of water, a body of water that's clear and pure and no mud is, you know, just completely clear, we often will refer to that as beautiful water, or the skies when the absence of smog and looking out across the land and seeing the mountains in the distance, there's a beauty there, and beauty of absence, of being clean, of being clear. Sometimes things that are really clean have a sense of beauty in them, clean being the absence of dirt. And so the mind also, as it becomes cleaner and cleaner, more and more absence of agitation, absence of preoccupations and concerns and absence of greed, hate, and delusion, becomes beautiful, maybe not so much because it's inherently beautiful, but rather beautiful because the clarity and the absence of these things is so beautiful and nice. So finally, this as the mind settles, as we quiet the mind and free the mind from its agitation, its preoccupations, its attachments, its greed, its hatred, its delusions, even its fears, anxieties, then part of what becomes clear, settled or open like water or the skies without smog, is awareness itself, is the capacity to know or to observe. And the Buddha talks about there being a beautiful observer, a beautiful witnessing that we have and within. One of the quotes where he talks about this, he does tie it to our ethics. He says that there's a kind of a poem, and the poem has to do with how when no matter what we do and act on, both body, mind, and thought, we can't really hide from things that are done badly, things that are ill. There exists no hiding place for those who have done ill. There exists no hiding place for those who have done ill. So if we've acted from greed, hate, and delusion, or intentionally harmed people, broken the precepts, you can't really hide from having done that. And the reason for that, the Buddha says, is because you yourself will know what is true and what is false. You yourself will know what you have done and what the whether it's ill or beautiful. You, and then he uses the word friend, you, dear friend, neglect yourself in neglecting the beautiful witnessing within. You yourself neglect yourself in neglecting the beautiful witnessing within. This capacity to know and be aware is a beautiful quality. And when it's there, then we'll do the moral accounting, the moral house cleaning that, you know, is really necessary for this clearing out and discovering more and more of this beauty we have. So discovering the beautiful witnessing within. And that's what we're discovering through mindfulness practice, the capacity to see beautifully and observe beautifully. And the awareness itself becomes beautiful when it's not agitated and preoccupied and limited in some ways. And then we come to this wonderful thing, fantastic thing. And that is that the beautiful witnessing can witness that which is beautiful. The beautiful breathing, the beautiful sense of clarity and relaxation, openness in the body, the beauty, beautiful qualities of the mind's capacity for all kinds of goodness, the mind's capacity for freedom, the mind's capacity for the absence of greed, hate, and delusion. And this meeting of the beautiful witness and the beauty within and the beauty without, what a fantastic meeting that is. Beauty meets beauty. And when there's the most beautiful meeting of beauty and beauty, of awareness, the beautiful awareness, and the beauty that's within, something completely revolutionary can happen. And then we can discover the greatest beauty that is possible for a human being, the radical absence of greed, hate, and delusion, the cessation of attachments, of agitation, that is, the tradition kind of says it's not a worldly experience, like the fourth jhana is a worldly, highest worldly beauty, but the radical cessation of greed, hate, and delusion, that then also becomes the preeminent source within us, as the Buddha said, of is the source, the cause and condition for beautiful actions, for the occurrence of beautiful actions. And this idea that how we live our lives is important. How we live our lives in this world. and to live in the world for the good of all through coming from, acting from, action that's based on whatever degree we have of absence of attachment, absence of greed, absence of hatred, absence of delusion. That's the purpose of this whole teachings about the beauty of the Dharma. The Dharma is good and is beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, and beautiful in the end. At the end, it's most beautiful. And may you take whatever beauty that you know of, whatever place of harmony, of goodness, of virtue, of unity, of wholeness that you tap into, let you really recognize what's really good about that, really beautiful about that, and let it be the source from which you live your life. May you practice in beauty. May you serve this world in beauty. Thank you. And I guess sometimes on this Fridays, I've tried to take some questions, and I have a little bit of time. If some of you would like to try to enter some questions in the, those of you who can stay for a little bit longer, you're welcome to, if you wanted to try to type something in, and I'll try to do them in order, but it's a little bit hard if they come really fast. I'll do my best if you want, if you have something. It's just a delight to see the thanks and the names and the bows, the namastes that come up, and it's very nice. Every single one. Is there a connection between vijnana and papancha? Well, vijnana, the spelling is different than I know it, but if vijnana means consciousness and papancha, it's a good question. I don't really know if I have the answer for that. But papancha is proliferation of the mind, just thinking a lot, or objectifying the world a lot, me here and you there. And you need consciousness to do that. You need to have the ability to distinguish between self and other there. So I guess there one requires the other. But, you know, what's interesting in the Dharma, because yesterday I talked about the beautiful mind, is that consciousness is not necessarily seen as a great, wonderful thing, or vijnana is not a great, wonderful thing in Buddhism. And so it's a little bit hard for us to translate vijnana as consciousness, because the tendency in English is to see consciousness as a neutral, natural, inherent thing of who we are. And then to see it being, the Buddha sees it as a problem, and that we're looking at the cessation and the ending of consciousness, that doesn't make any sense in the way we talk in English. So I think there's a problem with translating vijnana as consciousness. But citta is never problematic. And citta does not caught up in, when the citta is free, no problems in the mind. So let me see what I can find here. Are you continuing these morning meditations next week? Oh, yes, next week. Yes, they'll continue next week. And next week I thought about talking about the Buddha's teachings on care, anukampa. And it turns out that very surprisingly, and very inspiringly, that karuna or compassion does not have the central role in the teachings of the Buddha, as people have often assumed it's there. But there's something else that's very comparable, holds the same place, that I think is, for me, is actually more inspiring than how inspired I am by compassion. It's a wonderful thing. Is this anukampa, this care, which is more fundamental. And so it's not well known, this idea. So I think I'll talk about that next for the next week, for the next 5 days. And the plan is to keep doing this indefinitely, I guess, these mornings. I'm enjoying them, and I hope that you enjoy them. So is the mind that observes the same as the mind that thinks, or are they separate? Yeah, I don't think we can separate very sharply the thinking mind from the observing mind. There's no absolute separation there. But it is possible for the thinking mind to get quieter and quieter and less abstract and less busy and less kind of abstract and less stories about things. And this quieting of the mind so that thinking gets simpler and simpler, there's still cognition, and some people might call it a very simple rudimentary cognition of a mind that seems to mostly just observe or is aware as having no thoughts. And other people say, well, as long as there's cognition, that's a kind of thought as well. And I'm more in that camp, so that the idea of there's pure observation without any kind of thoughts at all, this is a philosophical question. I don't want to argue it, but I kind of assume that there's always some rudimentary cognition, thinking, even the most simplest and purest forms of observation. Who knows? Let's see. What is emptiness? Emptiness is the absence of something. And so there is certain things which human beings do a tremendous amount of projecting. We project our ideas, our concepts, our memories, our associations onto reality. And some of those are definitely having to do with our life story, our biography, what's happened to us. And some of it is deeper than that and has to do with the fundamental kind of projections of things like permanence, projections of self, projection of a certain kind of happiness in things and expectations from things. And when these projections stop and we're no longer projecting self and permanence onto our experience, that's when there's a possibility for the mind to relax or let go in a very deep way. And so this relaxing with the insight into emptiness is one of the conditions for awakening. And then do you have advice on whether to change the legs you are furthest forward when sitting regularly? Oh, well, I do have advice, but I don't follow my own advice, so I don't know if I should say it. On principle, I think it's, probably a good yoga teacher will say that you should regularly change which leg is in front if you're sitting cross-legged. Just so that the very subtle ways in which the body stretches differently and depending on which leg's in front. So you stretch evenly in both ways. And I do that too, but I do it maybe once every 10 years or 15 years, I change which leg's in the front. So I'm not really following my own advice. And I think that one of the reasons I don't do it so often is that there's a kind of settling into the posture that happens and familiarity with it and ease with it that supports meditation. And so if I switch the legs, then I'm a little bit off kilter for a little while until I get used to it and settle into it. So I'm maybe a little bit lazy or maybe a little bit kind of just go along with what I have. And I only change it if I feel there's a need, like I injured my knee or something. So I'm not very satisfied with my answer, so hopefully, Kate, you can find your way with that. When caught in an angry thought about someone else, what is the best practice to focus on? What is beautiful? When caught in an angry thought about someone else, what is the best practice to focus on that is beautiful? I think that we should focus. For the purpose of mindfulness practice, which sometimes the anger is strong, you need to do something different. So there's two general thoughts, ideas. One is that if you're able to have mindfulness which is stronger than the anger, then the mindfulness practice is a turn and look at the anger. But the anger usually has an object, something we're angry about. And the mindfulness practice is to turn the attention around 180 degrees and look at what it's like to be angry. And so the reason you're angry is not so important for the purposes of mindfulness. It's important for other reasons. But those reasons, you're better able to look at them after you've just gotten settled and calm and there's no longer any anger. So turn around 180 degrees, look at the anger, and then try to look at the anger without any anger, without any attachments or pushing away or embarrassment or shame, or just almost like you allow the anger to be there in awareness. And that's where the beauty is, in how you allow, how you're equanimous about being angry and how you look at it. If you can't do something like that, then sometimes in order to settle the mind so you can have some wisdom and not be so angry, it might be useful to go find something outside that's beautiful. Go out in nature, read some Dharma quote or poetry that really is beautiful and inspires you. So go find a friend who you think is nice to be with, that's settling for you and gives you a whole different, listen to a Dharma talk perhaps that's inspiring for you. Do something that distracts you, that changes your mood, changes how you are. But don't do that to escape the anger. Do that to simply quiet the mind so you're no longer angry, and then go back and reflect about what happened. Then think deeply about the causes and conditions for the anger, what happened, and also what needs to be done. Does anything need to change and be done in the world? So I think I'll stop. I'm getting a little bit feeling it's enough. And I'm sorry for the people that asked questions and didn't ask. I love it that people ask questions, and I appreciate everyone. And I'll look at them all when I sit down a little bit later. And I want to thank you very, very much for this. And I look forward to continuing this next week and sitting with you. And we'll look at this, this other aspect of what's beautiful, our capacity to care. So thank you very much.